This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Unless something goes wrong, I'm not coming in tomorrow. So today was my last billing day of the month, although we have a little adventure. That's right, we have a little adventure that we're working on that I'm probably going to have to dial in for a few minutes tomorrow, see how we're doing with that. It's a long story. You know, when you have a bunch of different systems that are trying to talk to each other and you think you got it all worked out on your end, but then you pitch some data over the fence, sometimes it doesn't always land. But that's okay. We'll get it all worked out. It'll be fine. It only has to do with 7 orders on the web store, so it's not like a huge amount of orders, but, you know, be nice to actually get the customer their downloads. We'll get that done, though. It's been a good week. I've been able to plow through some work this week, which I needed to plow through because I'm finishing up on one project, and I've got another big project in queue that's coming up in March, and so I need to get this project finished up, but I need to get it finished up and handed off in such a way that it does not go to seed, because it has been a lot of work, and I want to see the customer get their money's worth out of it. And, you know, in order to do that, I have to have a successful handoff. So February is dedicated to the successful handoff and also finding ways that it can be useful, because it was a consolidation of data. And I hadn't bothered to count, really, but I went ahead and ran a count today to see how many stored procedures I had written for this, and when I ran the count, it topped out at over 600. If I ran the count correctly. So yeah, there's been a lot of work. But it, you know, it's coming together. There's still some work to do, tweaking, polishing, kind of getting clever in some things because of the way the data is coming from many different sources and some of it overlaps. And so we have a little bit of clever to come, but, you know, that's okay. That's all right. It'll all work out. Been puttering along on the writing. I'm actually, if I just go by straight counts, I think I've already written 3,700 words this week, which my target is 5,000. And if I go by my weekly counts, because I've just been gradually getting farther and farther ahead, if I go by my weekly counts, I'm only about 500 words from what would be my goal at the end of this week. And I still have tonight and Friday and Saturday. And Friday and Saturday really are my two biggest days. Well, not quite. Sunday's a 4-hour day, Friday's usually a 3-hour day, and then Saturday is a 5-hour day. So plenty of writing time there, and plenty of time to kind of get a jump start on next week as well. And, you know, it's very interesting. I'll have some retweaking that I have to do, but it's going okay. It's okay. I'm almost through all of the exposition stuff that I want to get set up, and I'm in chapter, I think I just started chapter 6. And I'm expecting to have 24, 25 chapters. And it's going okay. I like it so far. So I had to write yesterday, and day before, I started into a section where there's a little I'm using it for exposition, just to sort of set the tone a little bit. A little blog that is written by an anonymous person on... it's written anonymously by someone on... how should I say this? It is anonymously authored from the Dominion. It's called The True Adventures of a Dominion Pixie. So it's written very much from that gossipy, double entendre, unauthorized... somewhat sexually charged. There's nothing bad in there, but it's written from a fangirl's perspective, from a fangirl's perspective that is close to just screaming every time the women see Mr. Delicious, who is the chief pilot on the ship. That was a little interesting to write. I don't think I've ever written anything from... That's not true. I was going to say from such a distinctly female perspective, but that's not true, because in That Faded Shore, I had some stuff that was... but nothing from a... Well, I don't know. Nothing from a female screamy Mimi kind of perspective. So it was different. It was fun. You know, it'll be interesting to see what my beta readers think about it. Certainly, I've never written anything from a female perspective where the female was obsessing over a guy. So that was that was a little weird. But you know, it's an important part of the setting and tone, for the exposition. So, you know, hey, you do what you gotta do for your art. Anyways, I'm babbling and I'm going to be home before I actually get to anything of substance. So, this week, watched a lot of good TED Talks this week as I was going home. Wow, I'm trying to decide. I may bundle two of them together next week and just talk about living extraordinary lives. There was one TED Talk that I had watched that I almost didn't watch. I'm so glad I did. By the lady who finally succeeded in swimming between Canada and Key West, Florida. 53 hours in the water. Unbelievable. She is 64. It was her fifth attempt, and she finally made it. First time anyone had done it. And then I watched another TED Talk of a female Muslim comic who has cerebral palsy. Really good TED Talks. Fun stuff. But that's not what I'm talking about today. What I'm talking about today is a TED Talk by Paul Piff. And it's called Does Money Make You Mean? Which I thought it was very interesting. And I thought he came to a kind of really interesting insight on the end of it, to answer his question when he got to the end of it. They've been studying this, the effects of inequity in income and in finances, and inequities in resources, and what does that do to people. And they've conducted a lot of different experiments. One of them was, and really is very telling, one of them was that they would bring pairs of students into a room They brought in 100 pairs of students. They would flip a coin in front of the students, and by that would determine which student was the more empowered student and which was the less empowered student. And it was a completely rigged game. So the more empowered student, they would set up with lots more money. They would allow the student to go around the board faster. And when they passed Go, sorry, this is Monopoly. When they passed Go, they would get more every turn. So, I mean, the game is completely rigged. There's pretty much no way, unless the privileged student just isn't even trying, that the privileged student is going to lose this game. Because they have more money, they can traverse the board faster, and they get more money when they go past Go. They said, now, we taped the students, and what was very interesting was that in Time and Time Again, what they saw was that the privileged student would start displaying dominant behaviors. Like, they played one clip where this guy would say, rich player, well, how many 500s do you have? And the poor player would say, just one. The rich player would go, are you serious? Yeah. Oh, I have three. I don't know why they gave me so much. You know. So, and then they said that even when the rich player was moving their pieces around the board and moving faster, because I think because they got to roll two dice as opposed to one something, they would start banging their pieces louder on the board. Bang, 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 bang. As if to just rub it in, you know, look, look, I'm great. I'm moving around the board. They also had a bowl of pretzels beside the board. And some of these students had apparently read enough about these sociological experiments that one would actually say, oh, so are the pretzels there to trick us into something? You know. But even though they were aware that the pretzels might reveal something about them sociologically, the privileged player would eat more pretzels. That the more privileged people were, the more they felt empowered to become ruder and less sensitive to the plight of the other person and to consume more resources. You know, this is very interesting. You know, and the rich player would like rub it in. You know, you owe me $24. You're going to lose all your money soon. I'll buy it. I have so much money. I have so much money. It takes me forever to get it. Cracks me up. Now, what's interesting is not only did the rich players exhibit all of these behaviors, but then afterwards, when the sociologist would talk to the rich players versus the poor players, who were chosen randomly with the flip of a coin to get them in that privileged position, the rich players would talk about how, you know, they had figured out when they were supposed to buy the different properties and how they'd earned their success in the game and how their skill was what got them ahead. As if they were completely oblivious to the fact, or had chosen to forget, that they started with more money, they went around the board faster, and they collected more money when they passed Go. As if they were trying to justify how it was so easy to them to win, and they didn't want to feel like stuff had just been handed to them, but in fact they had earned this. Okay, I'll talk about privileged position when I get to the end of all this, but let's move on the way through. And what they found, as they've done lots and lots of these types of experiences, is that as a person's wealth increases, in general, their feelings of compassion and empathy go down, and their feelings of entitlement and deservingness and their ideology of self-interest increases. They brought people in, gave them the equivalent of $10, and then told them that the participants, they could keep the $10 for themselves or they could share a portion of it. And when they monitored the income levels of the people they did this experiment with, people who made $25,000and sometimes under $15,000 a year gave 44% more of their money to a stranger than the individuals who made $150,000 or $200,000 a year. You know, another experiment was they would set out a jar of candy and they would specifically tell people that that candy was for children in the next room. And then they would monitor how much candy the people would eat. And the richer people ate the candy, or more of the candy. Ones who felt rich took two times as much candy. They did this experiment where they just took a camera, they put it at a crosswalk, which apparently in California, when there's a crosswalk and it's marked as such, if a pedestrian is waiting to walk across the street and you drive up to that crosswalk, you are supposed to stop, let the pedestrian go, and then continue on. They set up a camera and then they just had their research associate walk up to the crosswalk, you know, in front of car, wait for the cars, and if the car let them go, they went, but if the car just drove past, they just let them go drive past. Obviously, they didn't dive in front of the cars. And they said they could take, and they, all the makes and models that came through, looked up how much those cars cost, and they said close to 50% of the cars in the most expensive category broke the law. There was a non-trivial statistical difference between the people who were driving less expensive cars and the people who were driving more expensive cars as to whether or not they stopped for the people in the crosswalks. And they said they've run other studies that found that wealthy individuals are more likely to lie in negotiations to endorse unethical behavior at work, like stealing cash from the cash register, taking bribes, and lying to customers. Oh, we have a policeman down here. Really? Maybe should call my renter and ask if everything's okay. I will do that in a little bit. Hopefully, he isn't hauling someone off. That would be bad. I'm getting my mail. One moment. Anyways, the interesting conclusion they came to in all of this was that obviously all of us are struggling. And they did say this. They did acknowledge that all of us have a day-to-day struggle with making the right choices. In the talk, Paul Pitt said, in fact, I think we all in our day-to-day, minute-by-minute lives struggle with these competing motivations of when or if to put our own interest above the interests of other people. And that's understandable because the American dream is an idea in which we all have an opportunity to succeed and prosper as long as we apply ourselves and work hard. And a piece of that means that sometimes you need to put your own interest above the interest and well-being of other people around you. But what we're finding is that the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to pursue a vision of personal success, of achievement and accomplishment to the detriment of others. So, what's interesting, though, and I'll wrap this up because I'm getting home, and now I'm curious as to why the policeman was driving down my driveway. What's interesting about all this is they did find that there was something that could blunt this type of behavior. And what they found, wow, bright sun in my eyes as I'm putting down the garage door. What they found was that just reminding people of the needs of others could often reverse this. They said, we looked at how willing people were to offer up their own time to a stranger when presented to them in the lab who was success. After watching a video that served the needs of others, it showed the needs of others. An hour later, rich people became just as generous of their own time to help out this other person, a stranger, as someone who was poor, suggesting that these differences are not innate or categorical, but are so malleable to slight changes in people's values and little nudges of compassion and bumps of empathy. In other words, if you can just touch people and remind them that there are others who are hurting, who need help in life, that you can awaken something in people. And what are you awakening? Well, in my framework, what you're doing is you're awakening the spirit. Because I think what's going on here is obviously that the flesh is very good about finding any spot where we might be more inclined to let it influence our behavior. And honestly, as I was thinking about this, I was thinking that maybe what's going on is that the flesh keeps this constant roar going on of anxiety, of the terror of non-existence, of the desire for convenience, the desire for control, the desire for certainty. It just keeps that roar going all the time under the surface in us, that it uses that then. As it's keeping that roar going, it's keeping us primed to want some solutions for that. And any minuscule, easy, incremental solution for that, then it then proposes, it knows that we'll jump at it. So if it's constantly talking to us about how life needs to be more convenient, and we need to be more control, and we need to be more certain about things, and you know, oh, if you could just have those things, that would make you happy. Oh, make you happy. Oh, make you happy. Then even when people come in and suddenly they have wealth, even if it's funny money wealth in Monopoly, it can say, oh, this is great. Ah, you got it over the other person. And it can push us then into just thinking only of ourselves. And once it gets us thinking only of ourselves, then it can turn us into very rude, ugly people. You know, I remember saying this back when I was in my 20s, and I'm 55 now, that you can tell a lot about a person not by how they treat their equals, but how they treat the people who pose no threat to them. I remember years and years and years and years and years ago, I had gone over to the conference center of my major client because I was working in food services and I was going to, I think, help serve a meal over there. I'd gone over there and there was a minister who was checking in to stay there, and something had gone wrong and he was just, you know, berating the poor little person who worked behind the desk. And I remember thinking at the time, this is very sad that a minister of Jesus Christ, who should understand the principles of love, just because he's been inconvenienced, thinks it's okay for him to treat another human being rudely. There have been times when I have cringed when I have been out to eat at restaurants with fellow Christians who, when the first thing goes wrong with their service at the restaurant, they feel justified in rude behavior towards their servers. And that just makes me cringe. Because we're better than that. We should be better than that. And I think, just like the article says, that the true inoculation against behaving like this is the remembrance that we are all human beings, is the love for our fellow man and fellow woman, is the empathy of understanding that the place of privilege that really all Americans enjoy, because when you grow up overseas, even the poorest American is far richer than many, many people. I was amassing some statistics for a little part I was writing on the book, and it was something like 80% of the people in the world live on less than $10 a day, and 50% of them live on less than $2.50 or something like that. It's just ridiculous. You know, I said I was going to talk about something, and then I forgot what it was. Privilege? Maybe it was about privilege. Maybe I already said that. I probably already said that. Yeah, when it comes to privilege, I mean, I think one of the things we really, really would serve ourselves well in this country is just to constantly, constantly remind ourselves that no matter what we've accomplished in life, we started with a leg up because we're Americans. I mean, you know, great. I'm working on a book now. It has 24 books in it. Or, you know, it's 24 books in the series. And people go, whoa, that's really big. Okay. But I've got on my wall at now, and I may have mentioned this already in my podcast, but it's worth saying again. I have on my wall a duplicate of a page out of the Ellis Island immigration records where my grandfather came over from Italy speaking no English. He was 19. He told them he was 23. okay. He was 19, speaking no English, coming to a brand new country, dropping in, no job, having to make it on his own. I think he had a cousin that he could stay with. But see, I look at that and I go, wow, that's hard. You know, me writing 24 books when I have time, when I have the luxury of being in a comfortable financial situation, you know, that's not really hard. Maybe the books will be lousy, but that's not really hard. Coming to America, not speaking English, landing, scrambling your way up, trying to learn the language, trying to find work, trying to keep body and soul together, that's hard. And a lot of what the people I grew up around went through, that was hard. So when I look at my life, all I see is this wonderful privilege that I really didn't do anything to deserve. I have tried to take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of me. I have tried to live an extraordinary life based on the tool set that I have had. But wow, I got a leg up. Anyways, this is Phil Farrand, and I have made it home.